1999, to serve as chairman and CEO of Mindshare Worldwide, which he forged into a global powerhouse by bringing into its fold the media agencies of Ogilvy and J. Walter Thompson. In 2003, WPP consolidated all agencies under his watch into Group M, anointing him global CEO. A passionate technologist, Gottlieb was early to spot the growing strategic importance of data in marketing campaigns. By 2015, he had hired a total of 2,500 engineers and analytics specialists. Gottlieb's ascent reflected a trend in the advertising business. With their deep pockets, holding companies started acquiring media agencies. In the United States, one of the first acquisitions was IPG's purchase of Western International Media, the company Michael Kasson sold. This 1994 acquisition had been preceded in France when the WCRS Group bought Carrot in 1979, later acquired by Dentsu, and in the UK in 1988, when Saatchi & Saatchi spun off Zenith into a separate agency, now owned by French giant Publicis. Eventually, each holding company would have its own media agency with a primary seat at the client table. Each agency had a large pool of ad dollars, which gave it more leverage to demand lower prices from the ad seller. With clients ever more reliant on the data and targeting, and media buying prowess of media agencies, their profit margins came to exceed those of the creative ad agencies. A big difference between today and the Mad Men era is that Bill Birnbach and David Ogilvy were media figures, says celebrated ad man Jeff Goodby, co-founder and co-chair of Goodby, Silverstein & Partners. Today, the business side people tend to be the public figures. Martin Sorrell, not David Droga or Bob Greenberg, is the advertising celebrity featured in ads for the Wall Street Journal. Observes another creative from Mad Men days, Jerry Della Femina. My agency has my name, Della Femina, on it. There isn't any agency with a human name on it anymore. No Carl Alley, no Papert, Koenig, Lois. No Doyle, Dane, Birnbach. Agencies are named very much like rock groups, 72 and Sunny. Della Femina overstates, neglecting Droga and Goodby and several others. But his argument is more valid than not. A second consequence of the ascendancy of the media agency was the further erosion of trust between client and agency. The media agency's hefty profits, coupled with assurances to clients that we can buy you media at a lower price, aroused the suspicions of clients that we are making millions, moans Publicis CEO Maurice Levy. There were reasons to believe agencies were extravagant. In Mad Men days, many agencies had private chefs. Profligate liquid lunches and dinners were billed to clients. Interpublic CEO Marion Harper once commanded a fleet of 5 airplanes, including his private DC-7 with French provincial furniture, a king-size bed, and a sunken bath. Harper flaunted his ostentation, once telling an interviewer, "We can't support people with little thoughts or little dreams." There are those, like former Ogilvy CEO Miles Young, who believe Gottlieb's famed negotiating skills can be traced to his upbringing in China. He's very Mandarin. He's very opaque, but in a good way. He reads the market well. He's subtle. Gottlieb declines to attribute his approach to the lessons learned in China, though his self-description qualifies as an endorsement of Young's observation. We always had the view that the less a media owner knows about what our objectives are and what our needs are, the more leverage we have in a negotiation. If he knows what I need, why would he discount it? Yet he appreciates that when the negotiation ends, both sides need be able to claim victory. I tell this to my people all the time. Negotiation isn't about shouting louder or handling longer. It's not about wielding a heavier sledgehammer. You have to have a strategy. And you have to have some level of insight into what shaped the other party's position. And then as gently as possible, you back them into a corner and force the outcome. And if you do it right, it doesn't get unpleasant, and both sides feel pretty good about it as they walk away because it was the right thing for both sides. And don't put anyone out of business because you're going to need them. The Chinese-born Gottlieb and the British-born Sorel shared a conviction that to grow, WPP had to expand globally. By 2015, only 37% of WPP's revenues came from North America, with 30% generated in Asia, South America, Africa, and the Middle East. In non-Western countries, Stefan Lork, managing director of the World Federation of Advertisers, says, "Understanding of the value of advertising has increased appreciably in recent years." In many countries, Lork says, governments push harder to support advertising. You go to China or Brazil and it's different. The first question they ask is, how do we maximize the economic engine that advertising represents? Not surprisingly, the Chinese government banned ad blockers. Unlike Facebook and Google, or media companies like Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, that confronted a red stop sign in China, Gottlieb and WPP received a green light. Group M has more freedom to mine customer information since there are fewer privacy restrictions in China. Why? Because in China, people know they're being watched, and because people are more willing to share their data, says Bessie Lee, who until 2017 was WPP's CEO in China. With China now its third largest market after the United States and the UK, WPP in November 2015 combined 3,000 Group M and other agency employees into a single Shanghai campus. Keith Weed describes a week he spent in Shanghai, where three companies, Tencent, Alibaba, and Baidu, dominate nearly three-quarters of all time spent on mobile, and where Tencent's thriving WeChat alone had 650 million customers. He experimented by touring the city with a local Unilever employee who carried no cash and only her mobile phone. They relied totally on the WeChat messaging app that afternoon. Using the app, they ordered a car. From the WeChat platform, we booked ahead on Alipay, and she paid for lunch on WeChat. They ordered merchandise from Alibaba and paid via mobile. They fetched movie tickets on WeChat. 6 years ago, he says, China was a pale copy of Silicon Valley. Now there's real innovation there. In messaging, they're ahead of us. They want messaging to be the portal to the internet. In India, where the population is projected to one day exceed China's, the government is more welcoming to capitalism. Visiting with Prime Minister Narendra Modi in October 2015, Sorel told a local reporter that India will be one of the great advertising and marketing places in the world. The advertising and marketing agencies his company owned or partnered with gave WPP a market share in the country of about 45%. Part of India's appeal, Rashad Tabakawala says, is that half of all Indians are less than 25 years old. Facebook expected India to soon surpass the United States as its largest market. With a contract from the Energy Department in India, Edelman Public Relations opened a 28-person advertising department in Mumbai. India is an alluring marketing opportunity, albeit with pitfalls. India's advertising expenditures are only 5% of those in the United States, Tabakawala says, and that's because there are not enough consumers with disposable income for advertisers to reach, and because a creaky digital infrastructure impedes the internet and mobile phones. While Erwin Gottlieb worked hand-in-hand with Martin Sorrell to transform Group M and WPP into a global enterprise, the future challenge that consumed much of Gottlieb's waking hours was how to master big data. Digital cookies yielded data that allow marketers to better target individuals rather than amorphous groups, but also to measure the effectiveness of a marketing campaign. Big data was the promise Carolyn Everson and Facebook employed to entice advertisers. And big data did one other significant thing. It granted more power to media agencies who used data to shape marketing campaigns. But this was so only if the media agency was big enough to hire the data engineers and convince clients it could unlock consumer secrets. The kinds of stuff that we are focusing on, the technology, the data, all of these things benefit from scale, which is a real amplifier of those capabilities. Gottlieb said one day from his garment district office on 7th Avenue and West 37th Street. The more touchpoints we have, the more volume we have. The more data we gather, the more we understand. Let me give you an example of something I could foresee. The Group M shops are going to be the guys who do the major ideation. What I see us doing is that we are increasingly able to slice and dice audiences into micro-segments, each of which will need customized communication. When you logged into a client's e-commerce site, we custom-built an offer for you in real time. How did we do it? We know what you purchased in the past. We know what you own. And we know what the next thing you're likely to need is. That's different from what I need. Each of us gets a highly customized offer. To customize, however, will mean that the media agency may encroach on some creative agency's function, as Gottlieb concedes. We might be doing creative executions to customize messages. Customized messages beg another question. How to define creative marketing? CMOs like Keith Weed like to say that the holy grail separating effective from ineffective advertising is a big idea executed by good creative. But when messages are customized to individuals and not aimed at a mass audience, does the individualized message shove aside some big creative idea? If it did, it would cement the rising power of media agencies like Gottlieb's Group M. We saw this occur when one of Group M's media buying agencies, Mediacom, created the Love Is On campaign for Revlon, inducing women to carefully apply lipstick and fragrances to open up to love and romance. One could argue that this was a big idea, but the idea was conceived not by a creative agency, but by a media agency, and it was targeted at individuals. We would see a manifestation of the rising power of media agencies in 2016, when Omnicom won a bid to create a single agency dominated by its Hearts and Science media agency to represent AT&T, the fourth largest advertiser in North America. These Media Palooza accounts, as they've been called, start with data, for the data shapes the narrative. This is not brain surgery. You don't need a big idea, Gottlieb says, choosing not to dwell on the classic big ideas crafted by those who'd qualify for an advertising hall of fame. Bill Birnbach, David Ogilvy, Mary Wells Lawrence, Lee Clow, Keith Reinhardt, Bob Greenberg. Big data is siphoned from three sources. Generally, first-party data is gathered by the companies that interact with customers directly, and usually retain their credit cards. Plus, from department stores, credit card and car companies, Amazon, magazines, and newspapers, and companies reliant on subscriptions. First-party data has the names of individuals which the company can use and can share. Second-party data is anonymous, but also contains a rich trove of individual information from various sources, including clients, data companies like Nielsen, Comscore, and a WPP-owned agency, Kantar. Anonymous third-party data is purchased from catalogs and stores. Group M assembles all this data and strives to match the products of its clients with targeted consumers. More than a few obstacles impede the data collection efforts of media agencies. Companies like Facebook and Google, who bank some of the richest first-party data, resist sharing much of it. Eric R. Salama, CEO of Kantar in London, its 30,000 employees rivaling Nielsen and making it the world's second-largest research company, expresses a common frustration with Facebook and Google among agencies. We really have to get into these walled gardens to really understand what people are doing and how they're behaving, he says. Mobile phones pose obstacles as well. Marketing on mobile phones is complex. Salama cautions, how do we test ads on mobile? and if the mobile phone lacks a flash drive, they can't show the ad. Talent may be big data's most crucial impediment, Salama thinks. Everyone wants to hire data scientists and engineers. The supply is limited, the competition intense. In the data arms race, Erwin Gottlieb set out to build a state-of-the-art data weapon, known internally as the Secret Sauce Project. Gottlieb was intent on building GroupM's own proprietary data system because, as he would publicly complain in 2015, Facebook and Google had their own ad tech vehicles to target ads and were, in effect, muscling agencies and clients by warning, if you want to buy ads on our properties, you have to use our ad tech tools. He saw other holding companies making inexpensive deals to utilize Google's DoubleClick or Facebook's tech tools, and he thought they were crazy to become dependent on a frenemy. He liked Carolyn Everson, was proud to be listed on her long list of mentors, but was not seduced by her luminous smile. They want to sell their impressions for the highest possible price, he says. I want to buy them for the lowest possible price. In order for me to accomplish this objective, I have to keep them in the dark as much as possible. With the support of Martin Sorrell, he says he spent a total of $2.5 billion to build GroupM's own tech stack, the unique operating system and supporting programming to run a complex application, in this case, their secret sauce. One day in a GroupM conference room, Gottlieb and Harvey Goldhertz, CEO of GroupM Analytics, shared its ingredients. The initial ingredient came when WPP acquired digital marketing company 24/7 Media. Gottlieb says the two biggest attractions of 24/7 were its hard to recruit 200 engineers and WPP's desire to block competitors from acquiring the company. Earlier, WPP bought KBM, or Knowledge-Based Marketing, a company that had relationships with 3,000 retailers and stored a cornucopia of what is known as personally identifiable information, PII, including the people's names and their behavioral traits. Now, KBM gathered sales data from companies WPP either owned outright, like Kantar, or those in which it was a major shareholder, like Rentrak and Comscore. In addition, KBM vacuumed additional data, providing GroupM with a range of about 40,000 personal behavior attributes, what people purchase, eat, read, watch, their interests and hobbies, along with their age, sex, and neighborhood. GroupM only has anonymized data, but it assigns each individual a digital identifier or persistent identifier. We know you're number 001, Gottlieb says. In all, of America's 200 million adult population, Gottlieb says GroupM has anonymized data on almost all of them, the exceptions usually being those who don't have a bank account or email address. What's key, Gottlieb says, is the anonymized PII. We rely on persistent identifiers, not cookies, and convert them into cookies. He offers this example of how it would work. Assume we have a client who wants to sell tomato paste. From available data on people who buy lots of tomato paste and tomato sauce, GroupM then matches these people with its database and comes up with a universe of regular tomato paste and sauce consumers. GroupM then aims a marketing campaign at them and can tell whether they saw the marketing messages. Then they go back to the sales data to learn whether the targeted consumers purchased more. That's one measure of whether the marketing campaign worked, Gottlieb says. It allows them to match this data with other data they've collected on the individual, Gottlieb continues. This also allows an assessment of the same group's other attributes. Do they drive similar cars? Do they watch similar TV shows? Do they fit in the same income segments? GroupM knows a tremendous amount. But, he insists, they don't know their actual identity. We know the family. We know the income. We know the credit score. We just don't know the name and the address. KBM does. It's not the law in the U.S. that prevents us from knowing the names. It's WPP's internal policy. Think of it as a spreadsheet, Gottlieb continues, with 200 million rows and 40,000 behavioral characteristics. To illustrate the difference targeted marketing can make, he turns to the consumption of rice. 70% of the U.S. population has not bought rice in more than 2 years. It doesn't mean they don't eat rice. But the 30% who do buy it tend to be ethnic, Asians and Hispanics, because rice is endemic to their cuisines. And they buy a lot, usually in bulk. Only 10% of the population buys convenience rice products, like Minute Rice and Uncle Ben's. These convenience rice products each only have a market share of 2 to 4%, and an American consumer typically buys only 2 boxes a year. If Group M represented one of these 2 to 4% brands, what he would do is create a marketing campaign offering enticing rice recipes. If I can move them from 2 boxes a year to 3 boxes a year, you've got a 50% increase in volume. An even bigger marketing opportunity for Minute Rice and Uncle Ben's is among those who buy rice in bulk. Since Group M would be able to identify these consumers, for the 20% of them who might be potential customers, his marketing message would be, one day you will come home and not have time to cook your rice. Maybe they will buy 1 box. If I can penetrate 5% of that 20%, my convenience rice has gone from 2 to 3% penetration. Gottlieb believes they have reduced the guesswork. Today we have evidence that this person saw 2 commercials and bought this product, he declares. With clients increasingly asking agencies to prove their return on investment by demonstrating that their marketing campaign was effective, and with clients willing to pay them a bonus for success, Erwin Gottlieb is convinced his secret sauce will enhance Group M's bottom line. But not just yet. It is going to take another couple of years for this to be fully deployed, he says. We haven't exposed it to all of our clients because we can't retrain our people quickly enough. We're changing out the engine while the plane is flying. There is also a security concern. Media agencies usually share clients with other creative agencies outside of WPP, meaning that Gottlieb works with an Omnicom or IPG creative team. How much of his secret sauce does he want to share with competitors? Like Facebook and Google, he has reasons to wall off his data. He also knows that the era of shared campaigns may be shrinking. Media agencies like his are changing in profound ways. If his secret sauce works, more clients will push for the media agency to serve as the pilot of the marketing plane. The definition of what is creative will keep changing, Gottlieb says, and the creative function will bifurcate, with media agencies, as his friend Michael Kassin believes, planning and executing entire campaigns, perhaps even the creative. A number of impediments may be thrown in the path of Erwin Gottlieb's future vision. He is aware that digital and consulting giants pose a competitive threat, but is he guilty of assuming that his holding company competitors are more inert than they are? Can he galvanize his own organization to discard the familiar legacy model they have relied on for decades and embrace a more scientific approach to targeting? Can media agencies retain the trust of their clients? But perhaps the primary impediment to Gottlieb's secret sauce centers on privacy. What is the privacy line Gottlieb won't cross? Although they could collect real names, he says, we will not cross the line to know their name. Of course, since they know a tremendous amount about each individual and have assigned a personal identifier to each, their name is not crucial for marketing purposes. Did he worry that Group M's abundant data on individuals is too much information and might be abused? No, he instantly responded. Could I get to a place where I have too much? It's possible, but unlikely. And to be blunt, we have nowhere near what Facebook, Google, Apple, and Amazon have. Gottlieb's statement won't discomfort the digital giants, for he is acknowledging their data dominance. But it would discomfort consumer advocates. They are shocked that privacy limitations are set by companies like WPP, not the U.S. government, which doesn't impose the same strict privacy laws of other countries, particularly Western Europe's. Perhaps because he lives in Western Europe, Eric Salama is acutely aware of the threat stricter privacy laws pose to his data company. "I think the privacy issue is going to become a bigger issue," concedes Salama. "In Germany, it's massive. In the United States, less so. I think it's going to be huge because I don't think most people have a clue how their data is being used. There is an implied contract where people are getting all this content for free. But someone has to pay for it. And the pay for it comes through advertising. But that's an implied contract, not an explicit contract. And people are being targeted on the basis of their behavior. And we need to be much more open with people that when they sign up for something, that they know what they are signing up for. If I go on my computer or my mobile, I'm quite happy that a cookie has been stored there. It means that I don't have to reload everything, and I'm getting stuff that is relevant to me." What Salama does not say is that media agencies are wary of giving consumers the choice of opting in, meaning that instead of allowing consumers to follow labyrinthine instructions to opt out of sharing their cookies with companies, consumers would have to voluntarily opt in before their data could be shared. While consumers choosing to opt in would advance privacy protections, it would derail the targeting dreams of Erwin Gottlieb and media agencies. 9. The privacy time bomb. The key thing we see in privacy is that companies have made a decision to privatize privacy. Christian Sandvig, associate professor of communication studies at the University of Michigan. Data, big data, and its benefits are cheered by client and agency and platform alike. But when data is the subject, privacy inevitably becomes a part of the conversation too. So it was at an early April 2016 Monday staff meeting at MediaLink. Often at these weekly meetings, MediaLink invites a client to bring them up to date on what they're doing. On this day, it was Foursquare's turn. The location-based mobile app was launched in 2009 to much fanfare, then lost altitude, and more recently had climbed to 50 million monthly users, $100 million in annual revenues, and attracted clients like Microsoft and Capital One. Wenda Millard turned over the floor to Michael Rosen, Foursquare's vice president of sales, who sketched how his company had changed. They still rely on the GPS in smartphones to follow and locate people, and allow friends to share where they are at any moment. But they've abandoned awarding stickers and badges and encouraging users to be christened, say, mayor of a local Starbucks, which was cute but didn't generate much marketing dollars. Rosen said Foursquare currently provides data intelligence marketing that can help marketers by gathering information from hundreds of apps like Snapchat and Twitter, allowing Foursquare to offer foot traffic location data at 93 million locations around the world. And they're not just reliant on the 50 million who have signed up to be part of the Foursquare community. Foursquare thinks of itself as a public utility. When people visit the app the very first time, they are asked, "Allow Foursquare to access your location even when you're not using the app?" Foursquare needs your location to help you find nearby places you'll love. Even if you don't use the Foursquare app, if you tap Allow, they follow you. As is true on all sites, consumers can opt out of being tracked, though this process is often cumbersome and confusing. Privacy advocates like former Senator Al Franken, Democrat Minnesota, champion what he calls anti-stalking legislation that would require location data apps to first offer consumers a choice to opt in before they can collect or share consumer data, a policy fiercely opposed by digital companies and marketers. Opt-in is required in some Western European countries, as well as in Japan and South Korea. Although Foursquare, like hundreds of other apps that use location data, doesn't know your name, they follow people, as Erwin Gottlieb does, by assigning them a digital personal identifier. They can tell Bed Bath & Beyond the path to purchase, followed by their customers, because they can tell what stores their customers first visited and what store they went to afterward if they exited without a purchase. By comparing prior and current foot traffic, Foursquare can predict when business is falling off or rising, and who the foremost competitors are. They rely on three sources of data, he explained, including first-party data on millions and millions of vendors, which is data from stores or credit card companies or vendors or brands that have a direct relationship with their customers. Like other companies, Foursquare fattens their consumer profiles by purchasing less direct second- and third-party data from a variety of sources, including government agencies like motor vehicles and the vast array of data traffickers, Palantir, Axiom, Experian, IBM's Watson, Oracle's Datalogix, among others, who sell non-personalized data to marketers. In addition, Foursquare has data on those who see an ad on television and then visit a store. They can tell whether you visited Shake Shack or a bar once or twice that week, and can target you as a likely hamburger eater or beer drinker, which advertisers will pay for. They can compute the wait times at checkout counters, which stores seeking a competitive advantage will eagerly pay for. By wirelessly communicating with in-store Bluetooth radio transmitters, known as beacons, stores can transmit a discount coupon to a mobile phone, directing the consumer to a bargain counter. Being able to predict foot traffic is an enticement for retail clients to flock to Foursquare, as Target, Home Depot, and Whole Foods have done. When Michael Kassin is asked about privacy, he skates over the surface of the question, acknowledging that there is a delicate balance. We all like to get Amazon recommendations for this book or that book. We like it because it makes our life more efficient. In part, we think it's great that people can predict where we want to go and lead us to places we're interested in. But the delicate balance is that you don't want it to be scary. You start to get worried as an individual when they know too much, whoever they are. Like his brethren in the marketing business, however, Kassin doesn't see a delicate balance when it comes to requiring companies to have consumers opt in. I don't think we've figured out a good way to have an opt-in really work, because nobody reads the fine print. We still live in a world where, as a lawyer, I would say that if you shop for a hotel and you go online and it says agree, have you ever read what you agree to? I don't think people read the language. Translation: companies and advertisers would be denied valuable marketing data because confused consumers would not opt in. Kassin is a true blue marketing man. His first instinct is to protect marketers. Marketers are awash in data. Think of Erwin Gottlieb's secret sauce and many of the 40,000 personally identifiable attributes it plans to retain on 200 million adult Americans, each assigned a digital identifier. Of the 130 billion daily ad pages displayed on the internet each day, a senior executive at WPP's Axis says they can follow about 40% of all online ads, allowing them to better understand what advertising results in sales. This is small potatoes, he suggests, noting that over time, Carolyn Everson's Facebook sees trillions of online ads. But by tracking what users search and watch and do online, Group M's Brian Lesser says, hopefully exaggerating, we know what you want even before you know you want it. Among its 2 billion worldwide users, Facebook assembles about 100 personally identifiable attributes and purchases, including personal information from many of the 5,000 data brokers around the globe who gather pharmacy records, store loyalty cards, voter registration, mortgages, pay stubs, and other data, according to author Sue Halpern, a scholar in residence at Middlebury College. ProPublica, which has ferociously chewed on the privacy issue like a dog on a bone, wrote, "Facebook offers advertisers more than 1,300 categories for ad targeting. Every time a Facebook member likes a post, tags a photo, updates their favorite movies in their profile, posts a comment about a politician, browses the web, or taps WhatsApp and Instagram on a mobile phone, Facebook logs it." Google has merged all the data it collects from its 3.5 billion daily searches and its YouTube and other services. And it introduced a Google About Me page, offering advertisers your date of birth, phone number, where you work, mailing address, education level, where you've traveled, your nickname, photo, and email address. Airbnb CMO Jonathan Mildenhall says of the many millions of people who rent homes, "We know everything about our hosts. Likewise with our guests, though it's a bit less specific for the latter." As for Amazon, since it is the world's largest store and knows what individuals have actually purchased, its data is unrivaled. With Amazon's Alexa in the home, the company can gather more. Alexa is an agent that not only knows what you purchased, but when you wake up, what you actually watch, read, listen to, ask for, and eat. In addition to posing a potential threat to privacy, Amazon poses a threat to Google. By 2017, roughly half of all product searches were being done on Amazon, not Google. And in challenging Amazon and Google's digital assistants, Apple tried to use the privacy issue against them, vowing not to sell your private information to advertisers. When 2017 ended, Apple announced that it would place its Siri digital assistant in a new HomePod that will be less creepy than Amazon or Google because it would deny advertisers the data they desire. Many other companies are also awash in data. Bank of America has comprehensive information on its 50 million customers. This data-rich customer base is replicated by every bank, Wall Street investment firm, and credit card company. Comcast, the nation's largest cable company with 22 million subscribers, has stored in its set-top boxes a wealth of personal information, from credit cards to most watched programs, and can combine this with third-party data to compare ads viewed with purchases made. Comcast and other cable companies that span the United States collect actual viewing numbers on millions of citizens. Verizon and AT&T each had over 100 million wireless subscribers in 2016, with a mind-numbing array of personal information. Telephone and cable broadband providers retain data about what TV you watch, what banks you use, what websites and apps you visit, what newspapers and magazines you subscribe to, what you purchase online, what stores and restaurants you favor. Those who sweep up data can chart what drugs a consumer purchases, and inferences about your health can be used, warns Joseph Turow, a professor of communications at the Annenberg School at the University of Pennsylvania. Data can be weaponized by marketers to target messages and ultimately to create what's called addressable advertising. Prowling his London office in jeans and royal blue socks, Keith Weed of Unilever grows excited as he describes how mobile phones have elevated data as a marketing tool. "When I started in marketing, we were using secondhand data, which was 3 months old. Now, with the good old mobile, I have individualized data on people. You don't need to know their names. You know their telephone number. You know where they live because it's the same location as their PC and the IP address this data yields. They know what times of the day you usually browse, watch videos, do email, travel to the office or dinner, and what routes you take. From your mobile, I know whether you stay in 4-star or 2-star hotels, whether you go to train stations or airports. I use these insights along with what you're browsing on your PC. I know whether you're interested in horses or holidays in the Caribbean. By using programmatic computers to buy ads targeting these individuals," he says, "Unilever can create 100,000 permutations of the same ad, as they recently did with a 30-second TV ad for Axe toiletries aimed at young men in Brazil. If they knew the target was fond of cars or sci-fi movies, a particular soccer team or type of music, each ad could be personally tailored. Tapping new technologies that can compute the emotional reactions of consumers reduces the guessing done by marketers. In recent years, a number of companies have emerged to create a database of thousands of different facial expressions, and software translates these into algorithms that describe their meaning. Using webcams and security cameras, marketers monitor the facial expressions of consumers as they shop, decide to exit a store, watch ads, or video chat. Apple's iPhone X, introduced in late 2017, recognizes faces, not just the owners. Obviously, the same technology can help detect whether a child is in pain after an operation or an alleged terrorist is lying. If big data was one of the flavors of the year in late 2015 and into 2016, targeting and addressable messages was an accompanying flavor. It was a flavor sampled all over the world. In 2015 and early 2016, Tencent's online media group in China entered partnership agreements with WPP, Dentsu, and Omnicom to access Tencent's consumer database of about 800 million monthly users. Together, they set out to develop models to trace the online behavior of Tencent's consumers. Tencent was trading its valuable data for the marketing dollars of agency clients. A new slew of startups emerged, hoping to either partner with or nudge aside agencies to help brands identify targeted customers. Social Code is one of these startups. Its CEO is Laura O'Shaughnessy, and it is funded by her dad, former Washington Post owner Donald Graham. After graduating from business school and working in digital startups, O'Shaughnessy believes that a complete transformation is coming in the way brands can connect to consumers. Back in the days when my grandmother ran the Washington Post, there were 4 or 5 channels to reach people in Washington, D.C. There were 2 newspapers and 3 television stations, period. Today, platforms have proliferated, as have the marketing messages hurled at consumers. Marketing became offensive. I was seeing messages that were irrelevant to me, that I didn't care about. It was a waste of my time. Like those at Foursquare, to her way of thinking, Social Code and its 230 employees, half of them engineers, were serving consumers, not just making money on clients such as Macy's and Budweiser. By targeting individuals on social media, by sometimes creating the ads and then using programmatic buying to deliver individualized messages, they were offering ads that are relevant to me, that are useful to me. And I can tell when I serve the ad whether that person made a purchase and checked it out in a retail store. The way it works, she explains, is they decide on a target group, say those who drank a particular beer brand. Their client, another beer brand, pays for ads that are created by her company or the ad agency. These ads are relevant, she thinks, because they are aimed at persuading a group of beer drinkers to switch. They serve up the ads, track whether the individuals saw the ads, and then, relying on store data assembled by Oracle's Datalogix from its many store clients, they track whether user 123, who was served an ad, switched beer brands. They are no longer doing what she thinks advertising has been doing for a long time, which is guessing. She dubs this her customer-centric model. They chart for clients what messages worked, what doesn't work, who comes to the store, who doesn't come to the store. It becomes, she believes, a game changer. Using this data, the brand can make changes to improve the customer experience and convenience, as Warby Parker has done for eyeglasses, and Uber and Lyft have done for transit. Unless big agencies learn to shed old habits, to move faster, she believes they are in danger of plunging down the same rabbit hole as most newspapers. Big data excites Laura O'Shaughnessy, as it does Erwin Gottlieb, Martin Sorrell, Carolyn Everson, Michael Kassin, and the entire marketing industry and its clients. It alarms Nate Cardozo, senior staff attorney and one of 18 lawyers who work for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, a nonprofit based in San Francisco whose mission is to repel privacy threats. I want companies to be honest with what they're collecting and what they do with it. And right now that information is really difficult to figure out. The companies don't need to make that information public, and they do their best not to. Under the long, densely written contracts most consumers sign when joining an app or buying a product or service, the terms of service that we agree to empower a Tesla or Ford to track where we drive and stop, or allows DMVs, credit card companies, Facebook, or Google to sell data to secretive data collecting companies like Palantir in Silicon Valley or Axiom in Arkansas, who in turn can sell it to marketers. Google, Cardozo continues, tracks every YouTube video you watch, every search term you enter, every result you click on. All of that data is tracked. And they're still using it. We just don't know how they use it. They say they use it to improve products and services. What does that mean? Even if marketers don't know your name, he says, as long as they have your IP address, the internet protocol number assigned to every computer, they can in most cases locate your building. Cardozo says he has two nightmares. One is the danger of identity theft on a massive scale. It's only a matter of time before there's a breach. That nightmare occurred in 2017 when there was a massive theft of personal data from consumer credit reporting agency Equifax. Second, if the data is there, advertisers, civil litigants, government agencies, you name it, are going to ask for it. What if you could subpoena someone's entire behavioral profile? What if you have a knee replacement that failed and you sue the manufacturer and the manufacturer goes to Axiom and subpoenas your behavioral history to show you viewed ads about canoeing? Does that mean you went canoeing? It means you're interested in canoeing. Advertisers would be keen on having access to medical records so they could market pharmaceutical products. The accumulation of data to predict future behavior has been labeled surveillance capitalism by Shoshana Zuboff, a professor of business administration at Harvard Business School. Its pioneers have been digital companies like Google and Facebook that derive their marketing power from shadowing citizens and using data to become fortune tellers. The game, Zuboff wrote, is no longer about sending you a mail-order catalog or even about targeting online advertising. The game is selling access to the real-time flow of your daily life, your reality, in order to directly influence and modify your behavior for profit. This is the gateway to a new universe of monetization opportunities. Restaurants who want to be your destination. Service vendors who want to fix your brake pads. Shops who will lure you like the fabled sirens. Success at this game flows to those with the ability to predict the future, specifically, the future of behavior. Success is more likely to come to marketers who harness this data to make it more personal, more useful to citizens annoyed by interruptive ad messages, but who welcome messages about their hobbies, pets, or favorite vacation spots. Michael Hussey is the CEO of Stat Social, a data company that has constructed consumer profiles of 600 million citizens from around the world based on their public activities on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, blogs, along with the email addresses of 170 million citizens purchased from data companies he says he is not contractually free to identify. In a separate partnership with IBM's Watson, its artificial intelligence arm, Hussey says they have identified 50 million citizens and segmented each into the 52 personality types Watson tracks, such as adventurous, conservative, liberal, conscientious, or open to change. In work they do with Erwin Gottlieb's Group M for Ford, they track consumers seeking to buy a new car. The personality type that is conscientious, Hussey says, should get a different message, maybe the eco-friendly car, than the adventurous person. Everything is about personalization, micro-targeting your audience with different messages. To an engineer, data is virtuous. It offers clues to the mysteries of human behavior, suggests efficiencies, offers answers that will better serve consumers. Data yields facts, advances engineers' quest to be more scientific. But as first Google and then Facebook discovered, that data made it possible to attract advertising dollars. The more data it has on offer, the more value it creates for advertisers, Sandy Parakilas, who was Facebook's operations manager on the platform team from 2011 to 2012, wrote in a scathing November 2017 New York Times op-ed page commentary. That means it has no incentive to police the collection or use of that data, except when negative press or regulators are involved. The mix of genuine engineering curiosity and business greed inevitably relegated privacy issues to the nosebleed bleachers. The privacy issue draws too little attention, says Christian Sandvig, associate professor of communication studies at the University of Michigan, because corporate America and the marketing universe have succeeded in submerging it. The key thing we see in privacy is that companies have made a decision to privatize privacy. Companies insist that citizens make the choice whether something is private when they go to their settings or they click on opt-in or opt-out. He disagrees. We've seen the privacy debate pushed into settings. The point of that feature is to inoculate the platform from criticism. People don't march in one direction when it comes to privacy. Advertisers assert that targeted ads serve consumers information they desire, and this would be impossible without personalized data. The Interactive Advertising Bureau warns that strict privacy regulations will slow economic growth because they threaten to hamper the data-driven growth of the internet economy. Without ads, content companies would die. Since there is no single universally accepted definition of privacy, contentious debates will persist. In his attempt to wrestle this ambiguous term to the ground, the great Louis Brandeis defined privacy as the right to be left alone. But where to draw the line? If I view advertising as intrusive, yet it subsidizes my free television, is it really violating my privacy? If I physically bump into someone, I am certainly not leaving that person alone, but am I violating his or her privacy? Some, like Ricky Van Veen, co-founder of College Humor, the still popular user-generated website, who in late 2016 joined Facebook as its head of global creative strategy, thinks privacy is overrated. In the early days of College Humor, college kids would send in photos of themselves with a beard at a party. And years later, when they were looking for a job, they'd write in to ask if College Humor would please take it down. Today, everyone has a photo of them with a beard at a party. It's the new normal. About 40% of all Instagram photos are deleted within the first 10 seconds. Why? Not because of privacy concerns, but because it won't get enough likes. People still care about how they're perceived, but the idea of privacy counts much less. Everybody is broadcasting themselves constantly. There is a body of evidence supporting the notion that privacy is losing popularity. In the studies he's overseen for Lippincott, Chief Content and Strategy Officer John Marshall believes the sharing economy advanced by social networks like Facebook and Snapchat has helped dramatically alter the attitudes of the young toward privacy. As you start to connect 7 billion people together much more seamlessly, you're moving toward a connected state being the natural state, and the private state being the exception. He holds up China as an exemplar of future attitudes toward privacy, as if a dictatorship heralds how democracies will evolve. When you talk to a 16-year-old in China about this issue, and they're living on WeChat, what you learn is they think of privacy differently from you and me. They know there are things they want to hide, but the hiding is the exception rather than the sharing. Having the public state that it is shareable can be equated with them being a good person. And the 16-year-old in the United States? same thing. What is similar among Generation Z and Millennials, he believes, is the realization that data about them is abundant, and their data has value, and they want to get something out of it. Traditionally, citizens willingly traded their attention and accepted advertising in exchange for free content. Today, he believes, a younger generation may be willing to trade their personal data, perhaps for discounts or partially subsidized content. Joseph Thoreau has co-authored a paper, The Trade-Off Fallacy, which agrees that many Americans of all ages believe it is futile to manage what companies can learn about them. But their survey results indicate that marketers are misrepresenting a large majority of Americans by claiming that Americans are eager to make a trade. Although many are reluctantly resigned to the power of corporate data collectors, if a trade has to be made, they want better terms. Before trade-offs can be made, a critical question intrudes. Who owns the data, the company or the citizen? And have citizens really ceded their ownership when they click accept or agree? The entire economics of marketing depends on the answer to that question, Marshall says. It depends on one other question as well. What does government say? The U.S. government has at times stepped in to regulate advertising. Inspired in part by Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, Congress in 1906 passed the Pure Food and Drug Act, requiring what was advertised on food and drug labels to accurately disclose all ingredients. In the 1930s, a variety of New Deal legislation was adopted, creating oversight of how certain products, including drugs and cosmetics that might pose health hazards, could be advertised. Defying enormous political pressure from tobacco companies and broadcasters who benefited from their ad dollars, Congress in 1971 agreed that cigarette smoking could be a health hazard and regulated cigarette advertising. To protect consumers, the Federal Trade Commission is empowered to prohibit unfair or deceptive acts or practices, including false or deceptive advertising. And although privacy regulations are fragmented and not as strict in the United States as in Western European nations, the FTC has on occasion enforced privacy protections. Nor is it uncommon for the FTC to reach financial settlements with companies who are accused of false or non-transparent advertising. By early 2016, pressures were rising on the government to become more assertive. Federal Communications Commission Chairman Tom Wheeler proposed, and the commission later that year imposed, privacy regulations on cable and telephone broadband providers, preventing them from collecting user data and sharing it with advertisers without user consent. The rule paralleled the restrictions placed on telephone companies, which are prohibited from selling information describing which companies consumers contact and do business with on the telephone. The FCC declared, in Chairman Wheeler's words, that, as with the telephone, the information that goes over a network belongs to you as the consumer, not to the network hired to carry it. The new rule that applied to internet service providers was vehemently opposed by the advertising industry, which has long argued that if they so desire, consumers should be allowed to opt out. There is no record of consumer harm to justify treating web viewing as requiring opt-in consent, declared a statement jointly issued by the ANA, the 4As, the Interactive Advertising Bureau, the Direct Marketing Association, and the Network Advertising Initiative. Less than 70 days after the new Trump administration took office, with attention riveted on Trump tweets and news of the possible Russian hacking aimed at sabotaging Hillary Clinton, the Republican-led Senate and House passed, and President Trump signed, legislation permitting cable and telephone internet service providers to sell data about consumers' online activities to advertisers. The legislation also bans the FCC from ever establishing similar privacy protection restrictions. The government, in effect, declared privacy privatized. 10. The consumer as frenemy. There really isn't any significant difference between the various brands of whiskey or the various cigarettes or the various brands of beer. They are all about the same. And so are the cake mixes and the detergents and the margarines and the automobiles. And, I might add, the different brands of salt. David Ogilvy. If John Mandel's March 2015 speech to the ANA sparked a client revolt that year, by 2016, signs were